Okay, we're here. We are for episode 120, I believe. 120, correct?
Oh, 120.
I think it's 120. I'll check. Tonight we agreed to talk about Zog, the Zionist occupation government conspiracy theory. Went through some conventional sources, mainstream sources, to find out what this is. And this is, of course, according to Wikipedia and other mainstream sources, Zionist occupation government, Zionist occupational government, or Zionist occupied government, abbreviated as ZOG, is an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that claims Jews secretly control the governments of Western states. Other variants, such as Jewish occupational government, are sometimes used. According to believers, a secret Zionist organization controls international banks and, through them, the governments, in order to collude against white, Christian, or Islamic interests. The word in Zionist and Zionist occupation government should not be confused with the ideology of Zionism, the movement for support of a Jewish state in the land of Israel, because the conspiracy theorists chiefly name countries outside that area. The usage of Zionists in this context is misleading and is intended to portray Jews as conspirators who aim to control the world, as in the forged protocols of the Elders of Zion. It was British fascist Arnold Spencer Leese, already, who referred to Jewish government of his own nation in the interwar and postwar decades, while Nazis under the Weimar Republic dismissed a so-called Jewish hand behind that regime. In the late 19th century, France, the insinuation that the French government was in the power of Jews was a commonplace claim in nationalist discourse. An early appearance of the term was in a 1976 article, "Welcome to Zog World," attributed to American neo-Nazi named Eric Thompson. It also features as the main theme in the 1978 book "The Turner Diaries," written by William Luther Pierce, founder of white nationalist organization the National Alliance. The term came to the attention of a larger audience in December 27, 1984, article in the New York Times about the robberies committed in California and Washington by a white supremacist group called The Order. According to the newspaper, the crimes were conducted to raise money for war upon the United States government, which the group called ZOG, or Zionist Occupation Government. Neo-Nazi David Lane developed his version of the white genocide conspiracy theory in 1995. White Genocide Manifesto is also one of the ideas of those who believe in the ZOG conspiracy theory. The association of Jews who control the economic forces in the modern is the modern resurgence of an old stereotype, that the greedy Jewish merchant, which has been present in the Christian world since the Middle Ages. ZOG is also, you can find it in the ADL website. It's a hate acronym, they call it. ZOG is a white supremacist acronym for a Zionist occupied government, which it reflects the common white supremacist belief that the U.S. government is controlled by Jews. So that's kind of the official understanding of the ZOG conspiracy theory, the idea that the U.S. government, Western governments, are under the influence or control of Jewish power or Jewish interests. Read that, and, you know, there's a lot of, they kind of brush over the fact, of course, that late 19th century France, and also in 1930s Britain, that there was Jewish special interests, which had inordinate or excessive control of foreign British policy, namely, you have, of course, the Rothschild interests in Great Britain, the control of the Bank of England. You had the fact that, you know, Winston Churchill was heavily indebted to the Churchill family, was heavily indebted to the Rothschilds and other Jewish creditors. You had the role of the Balfour Declaration in getting the United States into the war in order to bring about the creation of the Israeli state in 1948. Because this was in 1917 that it was written by Henry Balfour to Nathan Rothschild, promising to get the United States into the war on behalf of the Allied powers. In return, the United States and Britain would work to create the Israeli state. But again, it's dismissed as a conspiracy theory, but we do have the reality of powerful Jewish lobbying organizations, cultural and financial power being used and being coordinated to pursue Jewish or Israeli interests. So, again, we're told that it's conspiracy theory, but all around we see, of course, the, I guess you could say, evidence of something like Zog actually existing. So what do you have to say? Is Zog just a crazy conspiracy theory, or does it really exist?
Well, I mean, both. the thing is that I don't use the expression. I'll explain that later. I don't like it, but I think the idea of just an honest analysis of our government, the United States government, or Britain, or any of the Western world, is that they are Zog, right? Because they are certainly Zionist. In fact, I can't really think of any government that, certainly, would just take the United States. I mean, certainly it would be a fair characterization to call our government Zionist, right? I mean, in the Republican presidential debate that had Chris Christie and Mitt Romney, some other losers, and Romney actually referred to the term, used the term Jewish state, right, in terms of Israel. So, I mean, that is a Zionist position, right? That it's, I mean, so that's the first thing, is that I think that the term is just self-evident that it is correct that our government has to be seen as basically occupied or at least inhabited by Zionists, and Zionists would be the group that would have the most power, because obviously we support the state of Israel, right? There's just no way around it. So from that perspective, it's a very accurate statement, and I think that there is a kind of semantical trick that they play with it. They switch Zionists for Jews, at least the ADL response to the term. And that's one of the reasons I don't like to use it, is because they'll say that it's basically a play off of the anti-Semitism terms, such as words like globalists, Illuminati, New World Order, Zionists, international bankers. And then they say that these are all terms that are being used to apply to Jews controlling the world. But I think most people use those terms are actually talking about a very small group of Jews. And also, I think Masons and other secret society members are in this lump. So they kind of, in the ADL definition, they play a little bit of mind control, where they make the position seem as though you're actually trying to characterize Jews in a general sense when you use terms like globalists, Illuminati, New World Order, or Zionists. For the term Zionist to, be basically used in the terms of Zog, you have to have political power. Right. So it's the groups that have political power. And I don't use the term because I think that we want to get people to think about the relationships between Jewish political interests and interests that, are potentially crypto Jews, like, the Masons, Bohemian Grove, Skull and Bones, and then beyond that into, anyone who comes into that world and seemingly has just a tremendous amount of enthusiasm for Zionism, for example. I mean, you'd want to get, in my opinion, you'd want to get some kind of DNA test to see who we're dealing with. I don't know if you recall the Republican debate. It was with Romney I think Rick Santorum and Chris Christie. And it was fascinating to watch because, you know, each Republican candidate took a more extreme position in terms of defending Israel and hatred and threatening genocide to Muslims. And then it ends up with Chris Christie, you know, like obese, sort of like Jabba the Republican, you know, kind of character. And he gets on there and he goes, excuse me, I have a cold. He goes, you know, November 11th, the day I'm inaugurated, tell the people of Israel, it ends today. It ends today. Chris Christie, I will enact a no-fly zone over Syria, and I will tell them, try and violate it. Just try. I dare you. I double dare you. You know, he's threatening World War III. He's just, you know, just this kind of drooling, you know, like bloodlust. But I think it's all theatrical. You know, I mean, what you're looking at is just they know they're all losers, but they're putting out the extreme position with the idea that, you know, Obama will now seem reasonable, right? I mean, his slaughtering of Muslims will just be a very, you know, petite and minute sort of process. It won't be like the extreme Chris Christie position. So, you know, it's hard to find terms that work. You know, Tim, it's tough to find terms that actually get people to think about, you know, what is really in back of our government. You know, when you look at you know, the Masonic influence and the number of Masons who are president and people, you know, in other secret societies, you just have to suspect that there's some centrifugal energy that binds all of these people together. And then obviously Zionism is part of it. And I would just say, like, you know, people want to, like, kind of see what I think is a definition of Zog, is look at the creation of the State of Israel. Look at the British political class, who are supposedly generally Anglican, and then look at the relationship that they have with the Zionists, the on the, you know, boots on the ground in Palestine Zionists, like Weizmann and Ben-Gurion. And what you're looking at is one group that's just negotiating with itself, right? Because if you study it and look backwards, you can see that the British political class, they were the original Zionists. They were the ones who actually started the movement that ends up with the State of Israel. So when you have the Jewish Zionists, Ben Gurion and Chaim Weizmann, and, you know, all of these guys, and they seemingly are having this tough negotiation with the British political class about what they're going to do with the Palestinians. I mean, this is just theater. This is like the Republicans, you know, having their extreme position. And then Obama looking reasonable. This is just theater to keep people from recognizing that genocide is afoot, you know. And so when you get to Zog, the term, I mean, I looked at the Wikipedia stuff, and I was amazed they had, like, white supremacists, you know, that had death to Zog tattooed on their you know, their shoulders. These muscly Aryan Brotherhood types, you know, and. I just wondered, you know, I go, well, that's, you can see why this particular term doesn't really work very well, because it doesn't get people to think about not only the moral condition, you know, that supporting, just without any qualification, supporting Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians, right? Because we don't have any moral restraint on Israel's behavior or slaughter of these individuals. We just support them, you know, without any issue. So, you know, you have this lack of any kind of moral perspective, you know, that the general public have. And the term Zog, I think, just turns, as it's been presented to the public, Tim, I think it just makes people, you know, think of anti-Semitism in a general sense. You know, they think this is coming from the wrong place in the heart. So I'm just taking the position that the term should really, that we use for this situation, you know, for the occupation of the government, not just by Zionists, but by some kind of really malevolent secret society, it should be one that immediately produces thought and curiosity, questioning, a desire to look at data, and a desire to enter into the Socratic method, you know, to try to understand what exactly is the reality of our world. And so to me, Zog, while it is a, you know, technically correct, and I think it's just self-evident, you know, that our government is Zionist. Cynthia McKinnon was talking about this pledge that, you know, Congress has to sign or agree to if they want to get money. So we are just a Zionist government, and Zog is, you know, while technically accurate, it doesn't, as it's been presented and as it's, you know, kind of used, it brings to mind more often like a knee-jerk response. And so that's why I don't think people should be intimidated in terms of the use of it, because it is an accurate and real thing that you're describing. But if you're going to use the term, you just have to, you know, bear in mind that you're going to be knee-jerking the sense of anti-Semitism toward you. And so if really what you're trying to do is to get people to think, this term isn't really going to, I think, be the correct one to use.
Yeah, I mean, when you say Zionist as occupation government, we don't mean a physical occupation. There aren't, you know, IDF soldiers, Israeli soldiers aren't, you know, marching on the street, on the street corner. There aren't Israeli tanks rolling down, you know, Constitution Avenue in Washington, D.C. And the Israeli flag isn't flying over, you know, the Capitol building. But when you have a situation like 2015, when Benjamin Netanyahu came here and he received 29 standing ovations from our representatives, they weren't standing and cheering because they loved them. They were standing and cheering because they were told to do it by AIPAC, which controls Congress through bribery and blackmail. And you want to know how that's carried out? Well, one thing is just through the Jewish financial muscle that's exerted, that's leveraged to buy up politicians, and they're very eager to sell their votes, and especially if they're being blackmailed at the same time. And how that's carried out, just look at the characters like the late Jeffrey Epstein, his operation, which again, U.S. attorney said he had to back off because he was told that he belonged to intelligence. I suspect that intelligence agency might have been the Mossad or someone tied to Israel, or maybe multiple intelligence agencies. Or, you know, characters like Roy Cohn, how used human compromise in order to exert influence in these things. So it's never overt. It's behind the scenes. And that's how, it's imposed on the country. It's an occupation of the mind more than it is a physical occupation, which is more effective because they control everyone's consciousness, and the most more important through their control or, influence, say their decisive influence, if not control, of culture, particularly entertainment and news media, overall, is they can control the narrative of current and also past events, and that's what's been done through Hollywood and through the news, and collect the names of the people on the board of major corporations, particularly media corporations, that overwhelmingly Jewish, they're heavily overrepresented. And the power itself has never necessarily had to be instantiated in a state, because with the diaspora Jewish power, it's always been able to work behind the scenes in various countries that Jews have inhabited, that their financial elite, to exert influence on governments and also the host cultures. That's what the Rothschilds did. I mean, as early as the 1890s, the Catholic Church, you know, not, you know, white skinheads, in their magazine Civiltà Cattolica, devoted several editions to what they called the Jewish question, and particularly it was on the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the French Revolution, and their position was, you know, with the decline of the monarchy, decline of the church in France, was delivered unto the Jews. And they talked about Jewish financial power in the 1890s and the problem that it posed to society. You have, of course, I alluded to it in the introduction about the Balfour Declaration. This was written to Jewish bankers, particularly the Rothschilds, not to a state. And it's interesting, in this book called State Secrets, there is a thing called the Landman document. It's a letter written to the British government from a Jewish organization. And I think here we go. It was under these conditions that the Anglo-American Zionists published a threatening warning to the British government by means of the Landman document. Addressing the British government as if they were speaking to an equal, they said in effect, "You forget that you did not give us Palestine as an unsolicited gift. It was handed over as the result of a secret bargain concluded between ourselves. We have scrupulously observed our part in bringing America into the war on your side. We call on you to fulfill your obligation in turn. You are aware of our power in the United States. Take care that you do not attract the hostility of Israel. Otherwise, you will come against a grave international difficulties. You will come up against grave international difficulties." Now, this is a threat being made to the ostensibly, I guess, the most powerful nation state on earth at the time. So power does exist.
Is that letter vetted? I mean, is that something that is contested as legitimate?
From all accounts, it's legitimate.
Yeah.
It's the Landman document. And it's part of the intrigues that led, you know, this 30-year process of bringing out the State of Israel, which required two world wars. Another example, you know, sort of this, I think it's, Zog has become more of a, I think more tangible and visible in the post-war period, particularly since the 1970s. But prior to that, you had, you know, certain Hollywood moguls, editors, gangsters working through the Jewish agency and the United Jewish Appeal to, you know, funnel all types of weapons and arms in violation of an embargo to the Zionists in Palestine. And to my mind, I think no one was ever prosecuted for this. A few fines were paid. So there was power, you know, to be exercised, and it was exercised, and it was real. And I think it was in Benjamin Ginsburg's book, The Fatal Embrace, Jews in the State. He talks about, in that critical period in the late 40s and 50s, Jewish power or Jewish organizations colluded to carry out with a policy called dynamic silence. What they did was, those people in the media, in government, who dared to speak up or be critical of the Zionist project, the ongoing war there, found themselves ostracized, out of office, out of a job, denied credit, and these things. And this was a stated policy of the Jewish organizations in the United States to suppress debate. And this was in the late 40s and 1950s. I've mentioned the journalist Dorothy Thompson, who was during the Second World War was very critical, of course, of Nazi Germany in support of the war effort. But then in the late 40s, became very critical of how the Palestinians were being treated. And although at the time she was a very celebrated, you know, pioneering female journalist, she had a nationally syndicated column, a radio show, and the moment she crossed paths or found herself in conflict with Jewish interests, she was out of a job. And so this is the reality. You have other power. I mean, I was reading an article by Andrew Joyce, and he brought up how basically through the culture of critique, the culture of tolerance, the culture of sterility, and the culture of usury, Jews have effectively exercised control over society, altering and directing its course in matters social, economic, and political. He points out in the article the overwhelming Jewish presence in role in promoting mass migration, not in the United States, but also in Europe. There's a character, a guy, he was a justice minister in Ireland, Alan Shatter. He was Jewish, And he's the one passing, making changes in policies that have facilitated the immigration of Africans into Ireland. There was a article I read by Toby Langdon, I think, that talked about how the treasurer of the Conservative Party in Great Britain is an Israeli. And he had been knighted, and he was talking about how it's anti-Semitic to point out someone's supposed dual loyalty if he's Jewish or he's loyal to Israel, but then he comes in a statement that says that his primary concern is the future of Israel, not Great Britain. But under his when he was the treasurer of the Conservative Party, and Conservative Party was the party, the ruling party, the percentage of drugs purchased by the National Health Service from Israeli pharmaceutical companies rose from like 5% to like 25 or 30%. So
Right, and
been
I
direct.
mean, the facts are the facts,
Yeah.
and that's all. Everything is correct. I would point out that, like with Zog, the term has a problem to me in that it doesn't bring in sort of Gentile participation or ported Gentile participation. Like if you would look at like the immigration policy into Europe, if it was just a handful of Jews, manipulating behind the scene, this would actually, I think, be, easy to stop. The problem is you have people like Merkel, the EU commissioners. I mean, and people wonder about, well, why are these people, basically genociding Europeans? And I think that the thing that makes Europeans have a hard time seeing, the malevolence in back of these decisions is because they don't get the concept of like crypto.
Yeah.
They don't get the idea that there are old family relationships which are hidden. And like with the Balfour document, remember that came out 50 years after, Palmerston
Yeah.
and Shaftesbury, the Anglican, who were of course Grand Master Freemasons, started the whole process to make the Balfour Declaration seemingly be coherent in any way, shape, or form. And because it wasn't just, that they owed Rothschild some money. I mean, they'd already been down there doing surveys. They've been like basically getting British naval positions and naval bases in position to defend the Zionists when they came in. They took control of the Suez Canal. These things were, it was a long-standing process. And it wasn't run, at least as far as anyone can tell, by Jews. It was run by Masons, and the political class. So I think that, that I would like a term that would, help people think clearly about, like, well, what is in back of the moral catastrophe, for example, of Palestine? And I don't think Zog really brings people's mind into engagement. I would prefer Zur, like Zionism is racism, or Zig, Zionism is genocide. And the kind of stuff that I would like to be associated with is not. It's just it's because I think this would be better, it's like the famous response by Weizmann, when this was before Israel was established, but Chaim Weizmann, when the first president of Israel, he wrote that, the British told us that there are some 100,000 Negroes, the word, Arabic word, Kashmi, and for those there is no value, right? So this was the basically the establishment of the moral position of Zionism, and it is 100% racist, and it is 100%, and there is no moral issue about genocide. So the question is how do we create vocabulary that gets people to actually do a little bit of research and not just, grab the headline that, white supremacists, like who are claiming Zog, Zionist occupied government, because I just think that's too far of a the mental chasm for the normie, the normative American mind to transition. They would basically, most people would just take whatever position they had about Zionism from the term. I mean, if they are opposed to Zionism, as many are, they would probably think, well, it's an okay term. But if they don't understand the moral catastrophe of Palestine, then they would go, well, that's just an anti-Semite. So excuse me. So that's the thing. The question is how can we improve the grammar? You know what I mean? So that people would, when they hear the expression, would try to look for into things like Weizmann's statement, because I have a Nir Masala's book, The Expulsion of the Palestinians, somewhere, and in it he documents the letters of the Zionists to one another. You know, he does a great job getting all this documentation, and you can see that it is Zur, it is racism, and it is also Zig, it's genocide. So if we swapped Zog with Zig, with the idea of trying to get people to, the term genocide, because if we could get people, rather than to go, to get into the anti-Semitic, moral debate, because that just always leads to, accusations, of like Nazism and things. But to try to get the debate started with the idea of, well, are the Palestinians being genocided? Is the plan longstanding? Are there documents showing this? So I mean, this may be just a dream on my part, but that's kind of how I see Zog, is that it's literally true. It's obviously true. I mean, how can it not be true? And I'm going to conclude here with a few seconds with a question for you about it. But I just think it's not, it doesn't get the mind of the normative American working in the right direction. It's too easy to just, they just go, ah, Zog, that's just such a general characterization. Perhaps I'm wrong, but I think terms like Zir, like Zionism is racism, are, Zig, it's genocide. That might do a little bit better job of, getting people to actually do research, to read as to what has happened to create Palestine. And also, so they would have a better understanding what the term Zionist actually means. And then hopefully that platform would be an area where they could go into, just like to start doing research into all the facts that you just mentioned. And I'll just, ask you a question. How could 9/11 have been pulled off if Zog didn't exist?
Well, it couldn't.
Yeah, it's just that simple. Yeah, and people they don't understand that. I mean, the government had to be many things, and the media had to be many things. Not just Zionists. I mean, they have far bigger plans than just that. But certainly, they were Zog. Certainly, to pull. If you believe that 9/11 was an inside job, it's just axiomatic. You're just saying that Zog exists, because there's no way it could ever have happened. Not only in the preparations, but in the aftermath, when everybody comes forward and just, has a ludicrous explanation for the events. Mm-hmm.
But the when you're talking about what we mean by Zog, and it says, okay, it's a term, it's an acronym, convenient acronym that was coined or created a while back. But if you can point out specific organizations and their activism, and that there is a network of Jewish billionaires and millionaires and agents that do work for a specific Jewish or Israeli interests that are separate from the United States or for whatever host country. And in the United States, we have this organization, the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, that coordinates with the ADL B'nai B'rith, with AIPAC, not to mention all the informal coordination that occurs. And this, you're talking about Hollywood, and Hollywood directs to New York Finance, which is largely Jewish. And so this allow this what this does, it creates a complete almost complete control of public discourse, and also what's formed in the public mind in movies. We talked about Gen 1's agreement in 1948. Now this movie conveniently wins Best Picture the year Israel is founded. It's about anti-Semitism, raising the consciousness of anti-Semitism in the United States. But nevertheless, or you have this group called the Mega Group, which draws in like the late Epstein and Leslie Wexner. And it turns out many of these billionaires have deep ties to Israeli intelligence. You have this group, Unit 8200 in Israel, which dispatches agents, many of the largest corporations in the United States, particularly in the high-tech field, have been littered with Israeli agents to get control and also to to get a hold of the intelligence and information that these companies have. So they're dominating cyberspace or the high-tech communications. You can make these connections. Not to mention, we can talk about how public discourse and what's accepted as sort of acceptable, or what's thought or speech, and how people who have called out or have criticized Israel or entertained competing or alternative narratives to historical events or are critical of Jewish organizations and policies, just they are deplatformed or shut down. And these things would not be going on if there wasn't something, like Zog existing, as far as Jewish organizations exercising inordinate and disproportionate power on the policies of the U.S. government. Recently we heard the stories of various state governments passing laws. It was Texas that made hurricane relief contingent on you signing a pledge not to support BDS movement. Florida passed a law that banned, anti-Semitic. No, what would they ban? Schools. I forget what it banned, but it was banning anti-Semitism, or was it?
No. It was some criticism of trying to think.
Criticism of Israel, was it?
No. It was you couldn't try to basically boycott. It was a boycott. Any kind of promotion of the boycott of Israel would be, or promotion was anti-Semitic, which therefore was a hate speech.
And the governor went, signed a law in Tel Aviv, apparently. Really had a ceremony there.
So that's all, you can see, it's money. But I mean, this to me is like camouflage. Money, I don't think, could get 9-1-1. There's just too much blood for just to be payoffs. I mean, when you have like George Bush and Cheney sitting there, and Bush is reading The Pet Goat, and the teacher is saying, plane hits steel while the thing is going on. I mean, this is a theater piece, right? This is just ridiculous. And so there is some kind of religious or moral hidden, thing. And this is what makes it so hard for Gentiles to think clearly about it, is because it'll always be someone who is purportedly a Gentile who will bring up this, it'll be like Rick Scott. I don't know if he's still the governor of Florida, but it'll be someone like that actually brings this insane, self-enslavement thing about, we're never going to do this or that because it might offend Israel. Because it's a Gentile, people go, this is seemingly reasonable. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like if it was just overt Jews doing this, I don't think the Gentiles would be nearly as, accepting blindly of it. And that's why the term that is used to describe it is so critical, because we've got to get Gentiles to move that little bit in their mind where they're skeptical and they start thinking about that. And if you have, LBJ and the Bush family, and if they're the ones bringing this thing forward, then there is this idea that, it seems a little weird to me, but these are Gentiles, so there's nothing, no racism here being applied against me. that's why I would love to see, a term that would get people, when you have a Gentile Zionist basically, accepting Zog, right, and creating Zog and implementing it. I'd like to see, a little DNA and some study of their background so that we can see if they really are who they tell us that they are. Because this is the key. I mean, if you try to figure out, well, how could Zog have pulled off 9/11 if they were 100% Jews, right, that were like on TV and, I think people would go, well, I don't know. But, when you have Bush and Cheney, the Christian guys come forward and give all this nonsense, well, it's more believable.
Yeah, but you have the concept, the idea of Shabbos Goyim.
Yeah.
I mean, willing to do the, the bidding.
I just think there's got to be, the idea that they're, kind of just been bought off or they're just somehow been seduced into it, I just don't buy it. I think it's just too, I think genocide is not something you would swallow against your own people. And this is across hundreds of individuals of political power. Hundreds. I mean, you go into the British political class creating Zionism, the British political class creating Israel, right, handing the thing over. There was very few purportedly Christian people coming forward and talking about the human rights of the Palestinians. They were all swept up. A lot of these are very wealthy people. It's possible that there was just some kind of bizarre reason that they wanted to move the Jews of Europe back to Israel. But I think that's nonsense, because if you look into their background, they're basically all grandmasters of Freemasonry. And you look into Freemasonry and you see that the rebuilding the Temple of Jerusalem is such a key symbol, such a obviously desired goal. That has to be what is really motivating it. So then you're into, trying to answer, Zier and Zig. You're like, well, why is it racist? Why is it genocide? Why are these people ascribing to it? I just think it'll you end up with the real perplexing question is, why are these Gentile politicians cooperating with something as insane as the Zionist movement of not so much in the 20th century, because by then they'd handed it over to actual Jews, but the Zionist movement of the 19th century, which was run by the British political class and the Freemasons. I mean, what in the hell is this? Why would these guys want to move the Jews of Europe to Israel? What was the motivation of it? And then going forward, then you have like 9/11 as an example, or the sinking of the Liberty, right? Mm-hmm. When you have all these these seemingly Gentile naval guys like McCain's father and all these people, why aren't they standing up? So my explanation is that they're cryptos. They are part of the class that basically took control politically, and they are just a very well-trained secret society that keeps themselves secret. And so what I would hope is that the terms that are used by people who are trying to get the public to be more animated, more thinking, more thoughtful, the terms would basically be effective, and get them to start thinking about this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting that what are the ultimate motivations? And of course, the whole idea of, crypto, which is, well known with Jews, particularly with the Converso crisis and the Moranos and these things, the false converts. And, this became a reality, I guess after the 15th or 16th century, in response to the Spanish Inquisition, there is a vast network, and we're not just
sure.
When someone draws out Jewish power, you're a conspiracy theorist. No, there are real organizations out there that define themselves as Jewish. They organize and they act collectively. So it's a fair criticism. It's on a exoteric level, right? We're not getting into in the esoteric areas here. But this is just hard-nosed real politics here.
100%.
Yeah, I mean let the same rules apply. In the United States, there are around 300 national Jewish organizations in the United States alone, with a combined budget of about $6 billion. That's so that's a budget that's it's larger than many small countries.
Well, it can dominate our media landscape 100%.
Yeah,
there's no way they're even resisted. I mean, so there's transitioning, just like they transitioned from Masonic control over Zionism from the 19th to the 20th century. Yeah. Same thing's happening here. I mean, you know, going back, you've got you have the Rockefellers, and you know, you have Morgans. These are purportedly Gentile people. But there's always these connections into Masonry and secret societies. But now it's like they're handing it off, you know, and suddenly you're getting really hard edge racial positions. And in back of it are actually Jewish people. I mean, I don't know to what extent this is a reflection of the Jewish people, because the Jews that I know, and I know a bunch, I mean, I just don't see this in them. You know, they are racist typically a little bit, but the idea that they would be engaged in this stuff is far-fetched to me. However, as you go up the food chain higher up, I think you get into that, you know, level of Masonic and morally controlled, and you know, there's all kinds of ways, like you often point out, they can control them through blackmail over sexual activities they videotape, and who knows how they do it. But at some point they transition from, you know, just humans to, you know, this elite group which has the moral perspective of vipers, you know, that they do things like, and so I kind of think that
didn't Jesus call them a den of vipers?
Gee, I guess he did, but. But he wasn't talking about the Jewish people. I think he was talking about a particular
the money changers, right?
Yeah, the money changers. Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, that's what we're talking about doing. That often what people say is, like, I think you alluded to this earlier, is when we talk about Jewish power and Jewish organizations, we are not talking about every Jew.
Yeah.
I mean, it's obvious, but only in this case we have to make this qualification or clarification.
Yeah, because
I mean,
you know, that's how they're going to attack the analysis. They'll say, well, dismiss the analysis because it's a racial general.
Well, when they say Russia, you know, tried to Russia influence the election, that means every Russian influenced the elections,
right?
I mean, exactly. No, it's just this former Jewish influence, foreign Jewish, like Israeli influence, in elections, in politics every day in this country. And then there's Russian. I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, but,
perhaps I'm being, you know, kind of hard-headed, but my opinion is this actually underlines my point about changing the term to Zig.
Yeah.
To Zionism as genocide, because, you know, I mean, ultimately, I think that the people, so many people just don't understand what the term means. It means that they are claiming to have the right to kill any humans who is not within the their racial religious identity that wants to inhabit this zone, mm-hmm. And they take this claim from basically the Old Testament, which in Deuteronomy has the genocide of about five groups of Gentiles, so that are actually.
Well, We hear all this.
Gives the go ahead, and so it's a pretty kind of crazy religious position, but it is what is ultimately in back of a lot of this.
Well, we hear endlessly with the Muslims about Sharia law, right? Sharia law.
Yeah.
What about the Noahide laws?
Well, right. What about just the Old Testament?
Yeah.
I mean, has anyone read Deuteronomy? Yeah. I mean, it's like when you start naming the groups that they're going to wipe out, these Gentile groups, because they are violating the religious position that the authors of this Jewish document feel God maintains. I mean, that is like, you know, the moral authority to execute the world.
Right? Well, I was reading, excuse me, the combined wealth of, I think, like close to half of all the world's official billionaires are Jewish, and they make up about 2%, or less than 2% of the global population. And they have a combined wealth estimated close to, I think it was estimated anywhere from $600 billion to $1 trillion.
Okay. Business acumen. They're just really good at business.
They're really good at business.
You know, and like I've said so many times, man, if you give me ownership of the Federal Reserve for a month, I will make me and every single one of my friends billionaires.
Overnight?
About 10 days. And particularly if I'm not audited, there would be no trouble whatsoever. So when you look at that fact, mm-hmm. you can see that, I mean, this is another form of basically of racial domination, and it's completely artificial. I mean, it's like the 911 of finance, the Federal Reserve. It's just ludicrous that the banking families that set up at Jekyll Island were able to gain control of credit creation and how much they could charge for credit. And so now, you know, they can basically charge one rate to the tribe and one rate to everyone else. And
yeah.
arbitrage enables them to buy everything. And then they have, like you point out. And
the dominant families were the Schiffs, the Warburgs, and the Rothschilds.
Who are interrelated. I mean, it's like they have the Schiffs, and then, you know, but actually these families are all just inbred.
But my point is about the combined wealth of all these Jewish billionaires. Why don't they write the check for aid to Israel and not the U.S. taxpayer? Why is Israel getting, $3 billion a year plus whatever is off the books?
They get 10, 20 times. I mean, the thing is that because it's all part of the financial enslavement. I mean, it's a twofer. It's like, you know, why would they, you know, troops in Afghanistan, you know, because everybody who gets killed is just a benefit to these maniacs. You know, they would love to see both populations reduced to zero. And the idea of like us paying the fee for the continuing military development and, you know, political life in Israel is just, it's ideal, right? The people who run the Federal Reserve, I mean, are the families, are, this is what you'd really want people to move their analysis, first of all, to understand, is who are these people? Really, who are they? You have some, like at one point you had the Morgan family. Well, who are they? Who are the Rockefellers? You know? What are the relationships between them and the Rothschilds? I mean, the first thing would be, we need DNA evidence. We need to know who these families are. But irrespective, doesn't matter who they are, you've got to end such a madness of an unaudible, private entity that can create credit out of thin air. Mm-hmm. This is an absolute formula for slavery. It's just because the people accept it. And we accept it because the people who bring the information to us so often seemingly are Gentiles. And we go, oh my gosh, I don't understand it, but it's got to be, you know, something that is at some level reasonable and something we should think about accepting. Because look, it's one of us who's bringing the information.
Well, that's the usury. The culture of usury creates the culture of sterility and funds the culture of critique and sort of these deconstruction of civilization or of the culture, its traditions and these things, which are largely spearheaded by Jews. You ever wonder how, you ever watch these movies, like The Big Short?
Yeah.
Margin Call, which is a lower budget one, but a very good movie about the financial crisis.
I like Margin Call. I actually watched that movie. I don't watch many movies. I thought that was a pretty good film.
Not many Jews in those movies, right?
No, well, gee, it's all Gentile. We have so much power in the banking system. That's why we have so many billionaires. That's why we have so many billionaires.
All those.
I mean, it's just ludicrous. So, Zionism is genocide. And, you know, when I bring up the term to the Jews who are friends, I ask them about this, they always point out, they go, well, think of all the countries we were kicked out of, you know? And I go, well, wait a second, what does that have to do with the Palestinians? I mean, they've Before, before, I mean, have you ever read the Old Testament? The Philistine, that's where they were the group you kicked out when you first came into the place.
Yeah.
They've been there forever. What are you talking about?
I think the official count is 109.
Yeah. But, you know, the point is that they have this moral equivalency. And it's very interesting to me that they would take the position that we've had this terrible history, and because of it, we are justified in just whatever it takes to set up Israel, because that's the only place we can be safe.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't a, you know, I mean, it's, so in other words, they're saying because we've had violence against us, we are justified in violence today. And I, that just, see, if that is exposed to them, right, which I try to do, and to the public in general, then suddenly you can't just be, you know, a public Zionist. I don't know if you've ever seen like the film of Joe Biden, and he gets, you know, kind of like, you know, cold cocked by this Jewish guy, and it's in a hallway, and the guy comes up and he's worried about Israel. And Biden goes, "My friend, I am a Zionist." And he starts basically just falling in love. You know, there's just hearts coming out of his eyes and ears. And he's just, he's just in love with this Jewish guy. And he's just like, "I am a Zionist," just right into my, well, okay. This is like, this needs an explanation, because Zionism at any level to advocate it is complicated. Right. I mean, you do have all these human beings that are living there in 1950 that weren't Jewish. What are their, you know, rights as humans? When you characterize Zionism without any context, without any, you know, without any discussion, you've bypassed the whole discussion that should have taken place, which, you know, it's the one that Marsala in The Expulsion of the Palestinians points out, that these guys took the position that there was no moral issue in the expulsion, and they knew expulsion was violence. They knew they're going to have to kill a bunch of people. So that's what I think we want to have people understand about Zionism. You know, if they want to like, it'll basically have a state set up like this, they need to take, you know, the position of honesty. You know, they couldn't. You see, that's my point, is that if they actually, you know, went to the public and said, "This is who we are. This is how we're going to do it. This is what the state's going to be." There wouldn't be any.
Well, there's two ways you can approach Zionism, isn't it? You can take the Joe Biden approach. I'm a Zionist, where he's more or less proclaiming his fealty to a foreign state, where he's a senator or a vice president,
yeah.
Which is problematic. Or you can say, you can take the position of the Third Reich. We want him out. Right?
Right?
Which is it? The point is that the Zionism, it creates a sort of a, there's a contradiction here, because in liberal societies, in constitutional liberal societies, the ones we presume to be the optimal political system in the United States, is we believe that we're citizens. We're individuals, citizens. In a liberal society, we're all equal before the law. All the same rules apply. But with Zionism, there's a special rule. Jews are special. They have a special claim.
Exactly. And if we just see, that's why Zog doesn't work, mm-hmm, as a term, because it's the generalization of Zionism taking over, and say, that we should try to get people to understand that Zog means that there is a declaration of a racial supremacy,
mm-hmm,
not from the Palestinians, but from the people who are basically bringing Israel into existence. They're saying we have the moral right, because God gave us the land, right? And the Romans kicked us out in the first century, but that was evil, and we are basically restoring this position of God's chosen people. And that's ultimately what is in back of the violence and the genocide.
Yeah, but most people assume with that special relationship with Israel, the special status of Jews in relation,
sure,
to Zionism, is that it confers privilege on them, meaning that their organizations, or sometimes individually, because of their Jews and their victims, they are immune from criticism, or the criticism that would be directed at anybody else. But it can also mean that because of the status, that society can put special scrutiny on them. and apply special rules, because this was something that in before the liberal order, when you had integral societies, like you had Catholic societies, like under that, there was an acknowledgement that Jews were an alien race that didn't go by the same play by the same rules, and therefore different rules applied to them. Thing is, Jews want to have it both ways. They want to say we are special, but we're only special to the extent that we're privileged. No. It cuts both ways, actually. Or at least it can cut both ways if you have consciousness. If you are saying that you're not just a citizen, you are a special status, that different rules can apply to you. And this is why I make the claim is under the conditions of the diaspora, creation of the Zionist state, any Jew who holds public office or in a position of authority and influence within a host society is suspect. And that's not being, I'm not being paranoid, is you look at the history that they all, and when they come out and they say that they ever, like this guy Shulgin, who was the treasurer for the Conservative Party, openly proclaiming his fealty and loyalty to Israel by being a member of the Conservative Party and a British knight, then saying it's anti-Semitic to say, well, he might have dual loyalty or conflicting loyalties here. It's just common sense.
I mean, that's right. I guess this stuff works.
Am I articulating that properly? I mean,
no, I get it. I mean, I certainly understand it. Yeah. And I think it's a very good point. And it's amazing that they can roll this particular, kind of logical pretzel out to confuse the Gentiles, because it's so silly. You know what I mean? It's like, well, we're absolutely, whenever we feel like it, we're going to basically be internationalists and have international connections, yeah, and things like this. But we can never be criticized by people who are nationalists and not Jews for being internationalists. You know, it's like,
well, they can hide by individualism when it shields their collective efforts.
Yeah, I saw it was a video about an aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean. It was a U.S. Vessel, and it was a Jewish guy who ran it. He was the captain of the boat. And he came out and he said, I really, think the most important thing about this boat is that it can protect Israel. And I thought, I just flat out says this. And I said, well, that's interesting, because, if I was like a parent of one of the kids on the boat, I would go, wait a second. That's not what we want to hear.
When he got his commission, did he swear an oath to the U.S. Constitution or to Israel?
Yeah. But you see, this is, that was, I think, but so, yeah. So there is this international and racial perspective, which comes up like when I talk to like Jews about Zionism, and I just this last week I had this discussion, and the response was, well, we got kicked out of all these countries. So you see yourself as a racial entity, and mm-hmm. have loyalties to the entity, which is, throughout all of the Western world,
which is cosmopolitan and borderless,
right? And yet, if you then say, okay, if the response is, all right, well, we want to scrutinize that because we have to be concerned about, basically how much of your loyalty and interests are directed toward the group, our group, the group who lives here in this country. That's like they've made that position racism, So mm-hmm. Very clever sophistry, but.
I think we haven't touched on, but I think the coup, at least mentally, the inability for us to articulate this, at least in public or public discourse, really occurred because of the Second World War.
Yeah, well, the Holocaust.
Yeah, because prior to the Holocaust narrative, prior to the Second World War, people could talk about these things. It was changing, obviously. Charles Limmer got in trouble for stating the truth about Jewish and British intrigue and getting country into the war. But I think it was Rabbi Stephen Wise who was very critical of Charles Lindbergh, bragged about Jewish influence and getting into the war after the war and defeating Hitler. So he more or less admitted that Charles Lindbergh was correct. But Stephen Wise was asked about one time about his loyalty. He said, well, we've been American for only, less than 200 years, and we've been Jewish for 3,000.
Yeah, so it's a special intellectual position where, they can be a very loyal internationalist to their race and their religion and also demand that they're never scrutinized as such. It's obviously, contradictory. But It is the kind of the mental lay of the land we have now. So again, it's the terms I think are important. It'd be interesting to see like what terms, you know, could actually start to be used that would actually promote reason, to promote research, promote discussion, Socratic, you know, discourse, you know, people trying to make sense of it, to break up the mind control, where, you know, so like, you know, I came up with a few ones. I'm not sure how good they are, but, you know, like Zionism is genocide. Mm-hmm. Zionism is zir. The racism, because it's attached to the normal American's mind, is something that's negative. It would challenge the person who heard the term to basically, you know, explain why it isn't.
Yeah, you know, because it was Jewish organizations like the ACLU, which is Jewish, despite its claim of being civil liberties. They, or the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, and these, they say so, that they fight racism, but Jews only talk about racism they can use to attack, you know, Gentile culture.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, I mean, look at the authoritarian personality. It's just, you know, ethnic centricism is a neurosis that you need a Jewish psychiatrist to repair and fix. You
know? Freud, yeah.
It's just completely... It's almost like comical, except it actually worked, you know, with MK Ultra and then, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll counterculture. So, so anyway, it's like I look for terms that will try to move people off the position of mind controlled and into using their powerful human brain to actually want to know. You know, I mean, I just think that in like our show, we have just presented so many hundreds and hundreds of facts, which weigh against the common understanding of history, right? I mean, like when we go into, you know, the Holocaust, for example, or to, you know, the counterculture, all this, the subjects we cover, you know, over and over again. There's enough there that any kind of normal person can be curious about whether or not the narrative, to use an expression, is really true, because the narrative is what sets up the intimidation. And then, of course, they reinforce that with, you know, the media personalities, you know, just driving home whatever the socially destructive point is, or whatever, you know, however they want to, you know, like how they attack someone as anti-Semitic. If they bring that up, what was that Congressman George, what was his name? He was had a crazy hairdo, and he was talking about Israel being, you know, evil, and that there was like, you know, and they just, I mean, the guy was just pillared by the media.
Well, they railroaded him. Talking the guy from Ohio.
Yeah, the guy from Ohio. And so yeah. Traficant.
You know? James Traficante, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And
Traficant, right. Traficant, yeah.
So whatever, I mean.
Traficante was the gangster.
Right, sorry. But anyway, so so the thing is, you know, so that's that then became like sort of the standard. And then people were going, well, I better not bring these subjects up. Well, okay, but there are, you know, data points that, you know, you should be aware of. And it's sort of like, you know, I read that little statement by Wiseman. You know, and he was actually just repeating what the British, but accepting and putting it into motion as a position of the actual Zionist political force. You know, people should know that. People should know that that was something that was accepted. They should know that the Zionists, the Jewish Zionists, took the position that that in the expulsion there was going to be violence.
Mm-hmm.
And that this was morally just fine.
Yeah.
And they admitted it, you know.
And of course, a lot of the, it's been said that the Jews don't have a history, they have a mythology. And the mythology forms their identity and how they relate to other people and justifies their crimes. And I was reading an article by Andrew Joyce, he wrote a pretty long piece about the Russian pogroms. And the mythology behind them, how in the 1880s, 1890s, supposedly there was this increase in violence towards Jews by Russians and Cossacks, and this precipitated the migration westward of Jews and also into the United States. And this formed a lot of the Jewish consciousness in the United States towards Russia, leading up, you know, for the next 50, 60 years. A lot of the radicals and in the United States, the Jewish radicalism was inspired by stories of their harsh treatment on the behalf of under the czars. And he just did a critical analysis. He found that there really isn't much evidence for some of the wild claims made about the level of violence. Of course, there was some violence, but it was wildly exaggerated. And the real reason for Jews leaving, Western Russia wasn't terrorism or pogroms. There was just economic opportunity. There had been a huge increase in Jewish population in the shtetls, and they left and they in seek of opportunity in the West, in the United States. Nevertheless, these stories of the pogroms and the harsh treatment that they received, that the Jews received, many of the Jews believed, and it formed their consciousness.
I've looked into this, and I agree that the way these pogroms, so-called, were characterized and got into basically the normal Jewish consciousness was propaganda. And
you also have the media operate, the Jewish media perpetrated these stories or perpetrated them. And there was a coordinated, this is 1888 to 1890s, there was a coordinated Jewish effort to promote these stories in the media.
Yeah, well, and they
so much so that they were able to, there was so much pressure brought to bear that they were able to get the U.S. government to rescind a trade agreement with Russia. This is before, this is when they supposedly have no power.
Right. And oddly enough, the number 6 million came up quite often as to how many were actually threatened by these policies. So they've had this mind control, the elite Jewish guys who were organizing this with their Mason counterparts. They have been manipulating the Jews just as hard as they've been manipulating the Gentiles. They've mm-hmm. been basically trying to create the consciousness across both ethnicities that they want in order to bring about the third temple. And I'll just point out the little witticism that I noted on the Sgt. Pepper album cover, Tim. Mm-hmm. You have Shirley Temple's image, appears three times. And I said, if you look at all these Masons on this supposedly, music album, you have to wonder if the Shirley Temple three times isn't actually a reference to the third temple, the idea that, the one. I probably shouldn't mention because I'm in as at a bar, and a guy, I won't mention his name, but I mean this is actually absolutely true story, and he's like a famous musician, been around forever, but you would know who he was. And I'm sitting there just drinking wine and after a couple, he was getting kind of lewd, a real idiot actually in a lot of ways, but anyway, I said, how come there's so many Freemasons on the cover of Sgt. Pepper? You should have seen him. I mean, he went rigid straight up. I mean, from being like basically drunk, it was amazing to see how I had touched the nerve, that mm-hmm. That there had to have been some, he knew that we were on, into the area that can't be discussed. When we're talking in private, before the show next time, I'll tell you some details about this. But this is the thing, is that, the organization is very longstanding, thousands of years. They've been trying to figure out how to gain control. They're a tiny group. They don't even have, I don't think, that much subscription among Jews. But they got a lot of cryptos, I think, they can work with, and they've got control over the political and financial mm-hmm. world media. So, I think that theory has a lot of explanatory power. I mean, I know I can't, give you like documents. I'm not in the club. I wouldn't be able to give complete evidence toward it, but I do believe it, and I think that this is what one of the things people should be thinking about, and they would be thinking about if they weren't so frozen in place, you know, by the propaganda and mind control.
Mm. And close out, I heard a joke. there's an old Saturday Night Live piece where Norm MacDonald's reading the news.
Yeah.
And he goes, this is back when Marlon Brando got in trouble, his remarks about Hollywood. And he goes, Marlon Brando met today with Jewish community leaders to apologize for his statements he made on Larry King's talk show regarding or saying how the Jews control Hollywood. The Jewish leaders accepted his apology announced he's now able to work again.
Well, I mean, that's kind of, you know, Norm MacDonald. I mean, he's, I think, kind of a compromised individual. But that, you know, I mean, the wit is there and it's real. It's just, you know, it's funny and it's true. Yeah. So
we don't exist. If you say we exist, we'll destroy you.
Well, anyway, Tim, I hope we can work again next week.
Yes. Yeah.
Because, and I'm sorry about my voice.
Yeah, get some rest.
I've had a cold because of I got it on the jet. I never get sick, but when you travel on those, you're breathing so many microbes. Anyway, sorry about the voice, but we'll be all fine next week. And thank you so much, Jim. That was an interesting talk, and good luck this week, buddy.
Enjoy the rest of your weekend, then.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.